This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. This hour will be all about climate change and how it's hitting home. Natural systems are feeling the heat. That includes everything from coral reefs to the plants in your backyard. And as climate scientists have said all along, there are losers and there are winners. When it comes to people, it's hard to argue that there are any winners, but there are definitely huge racial and socioeconomic disparities when it comes to the impacts of pollution and climate change. You'll hear about all of that. First, though, it's time for our monthly check-in with our friends at the Nature Podcast. Co-host Carrie Smith joins me now from Nature Headquarters. Carrie, good to talk with you again.
Hi, Heather.
A story in the most recent issue of Nature really hits home here in New England. It's an analysis of a form of fishery management known as catch shares. The goal of this study was to really test one of the key ideas behind catch shares, and that's the idea that giving each fisherman an individual quota eliminates the need for fishermen to race to catch as much as they can. Is that what they actually found?
Yeah, so they did find that there was a slowing down of the race to fish when they looked at a wide spectrum of fisheries. And that's really the difference between this study and previous examples, which have been more individual case studies looking before and after this kind of policy was introduced. And anecdotally, there is some evidence that catch shares work to slow down the race to fish. But the problem with these individual case studies is that other things just might be affecting what's caught and in how much time. You know, for example, the seafood market slowed down or sped up for a particular species, or fuel for your vessel got more expensive. And so really, it's been hard to address why the season lengthened. If it did, was it catch shares or was it something else?
So this study does provide evidence that catch shares reduces racing. As you said, fishermen here in New England, I think, could attest to that. And that's mostly a good thing. But catch shares also has had some negative side effects, shrinking the fleet and putting particular pressure on small businesses. Does this study address any of those socioeconomic issues at all?
The short answer is not really. They do, of course, acknowledge that there is a lot more at play than just this policy and just the kind of lengthening of the season. But the variables they're looking at are a little bit more constrained. You know, so maybe one thing they're neglecting is that fishermen might still race at times because there's a glut within a season, or the market price of a certain species goes up or goes down. They do mention the drawbacks of catch sharing, as you've pointed them out, but they really leave those socioeconomic details kind of to be thrashed out elsewhere, maybe at the local level and a bit more individually fishery management itself. And they do include, however, Congress in the kind of people who might hash out these details, because there are currently bills passing through on whether to restrict catch shares or not.
And that's a very current issue. In fact, just last week, a new version of the federal fishery management law was introduced. So that's definitely an ongoing story there. And no one study can capture all of it. Sticking with fish for another moment, there's new research showing that fecal matter, poo, from young fish can actually help old fish live longer. I mean, I got to say, it's hard to know how seriously to take this. Does this have implications for humans?
Well, there are good reasons to test this in fish, but we are, you're right, a long way away from humans here. Researchers studying animal models in order to get at the mechanisms of a certain thing before they move on to humans, they enjoy studying things like mice, for example, because they're quite related to humans. Things like fruit flies and worms, which are more regularly, which are regularly like the models of choice, they're not too similar. So something like this fish is still a vertebrate, so still comparable to humans, but actually very amenable to studying lifespan in the lab, which is what they've been doing, because these killifish, they actually live, you know, a few weeks maximum. So rather than waiting years for a primate or maybe even months or years for a mouse experiment in aging to turn up some findings, you can do the kind of, you can figure out what's governing the lifespan in these killifish a lot quicker.
And this just seems to add to the growing pile of things that we can do with fecal transplants. I mean, in mice, it can change personality, seems to affect the immune system, and now it seems entire lifespan.
Yeah, I mean, there have been trials in humans of how fecal transplants might make better persistent infections. And really grossly, these were actually delivered to the small intestine through a tube inserted through the nose. But yeah, you're right that this just goes to show that there are lots and lots of these links between the gut microbiome, fecal transplants, and this one shows the effects of, yeah, the sort of transplanting a young microbiome into an old fish. And in the case that they have here, it extended the lifespan by about 40% in these older fish.
Wow. Okay. Well, so maybe we're not quite ready to start having grandparents get a sample of their grandkids' fecal matter and transplant it, but definitely something to keep an eye on. In other mind-bending advances in biomedical science, researchers recently announced that they had created a model of the female reproductive system that they've called the menstrual cycle on a chip. What does that even mean?
That is a very good question. Scientists have actually talked for a while about growing organs on chips. Basically, this means a collection of the bits of tissue and the chemicals that make up a particular organ grown on a plastic chip, you know, about the size of a smartphone, say. And each little chamber of the chip might have a different aspect of that particular system residing within it. And these could be a great replacement for animal models, for example, as a way to test the effects of drugs. And they're definitely more realistic than just growing a few cells kind of in a flat petri dish or something like that. So there's lots of excitement in making all kinds of different organs, mini brains, mini livers, that sort of thing, in these kind of 3D environments on a chip that you could manipulate much more easily than an animal model.
All right. Last but certainly not least, a new analysis suggests that scientific papers are getting harder to read. I have to say, I personally was relieved that it's not just me. But seriously, other than science journalists who are trying to translate these papers for the public, what's the big deal here? Why is this of concern?
Yeah, you're right that, you know, obviously our lives are made harder by papers just being really impenetrable and having lots of acronyms and multisyllabic jargon all over the place. But, you know, scientists are actually doing a lot of reading themselves and perhaps not in their native language. So this kind of jargon and increasing complexity could hinder the understanding within the scientific community, too, of the ideas that they wish to propagate and test. And, you know, it could just be a sign of a lack of creativity, perhaps, or even a lack of understanding in trying to convey your own ideas if you absolutely have to couch them in lots of jargon. So maybe there's a greater issue for the scientific community here in comprehension.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is this a sign that the science is just getting more complex or that scientists just aren't bothering to try to communicate it as well?
Well, I mean, I know that at Nature, scientists complain all the time because the research papers they're allowed to publish with us are about 3 pages long. And once you're studying something very complex or even a niche of a complex system, you know, you need a lot of space and you need more words to explain, at least to the public or even to other scientists, what you're doing in that paper. So partly this could be, you know, a publication constraint, and partly just, you know, the individual complexity of individual projects, I think, probably just keeps going up.
Carrie Smith is co-host of the Nature podcast. Carrie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find links to all those stories on our website, capeandislands.org. We turn now to a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It's a new look at how two invasive plants in New England are likely to fare as climate change progresses. Sarah Boyce is Director of Research and Education at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket and co-author of the study. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather.
Which two invasive plant species did you choose to look at and why?
So this study focuses on two seemingly pretty different invasive plants. So one is garlic mustard. It's a small biennial herb of the mustard family and native to Europe. And then completely on the other spectrum, we have Japanese barberry, which is a long-lived woody shrub native to Japan and Southeast Asia. We really chose these plants because of their differences and because of their interest generally to people in the invasive community and as researchers, but also as, you know, the general public being aware of these invasives and dealing with them. So by looking at two really different species, then we can kind of prove our concept for different types of species, and it will enable us to kind of move our research forward with other similar types of invasives.
The conventional wisdom has been that invasives as a whole would probably, because they're such opportunistic species, would probably benefit from climate change. What got you thinking that perhaps that's not the case, that different invasive species might respond in different ways?
Right. Well, we, you know, some of our findings were pretty surprising, but we really wanted to look at the whole life cycle of the individual species. We thought there was some kind of other element that was in, whether it was survival, germination in the first place, and what seed set, fecundity, you know, what part of the life cycle was really driving the invasion, because that might give us more insight into how the species will respond to climate change. Also just how it will distribute more widely with under current climate. Typically, when when you look at species distributions and we're trying to figure out where an invasive could go, we look at where the adults have already established. And what we in our study really focus on was, establishment risk. So where could the seeds grow, where could they germinate, and where would they have a high likelihood of juvenile survival? And so that's kind of opened up some new insights for us into where the species could grow and potentially survive.
You weren't just looking at this going on in the field and kind of observing it. You actually collected seeds from different areas, different populations of these two species, brought them back to a greenhouse to grow them. I mean, is this part of what you're talking about in terms of trying to figure out the whole life cycle?
Exactly. So, you know, as an invasive species ecologist, you're often looking at in the novel range, so in the new range, where the species are. But that might just be where they've been able to get to. And so what we really wanted to look at is kind of push the envelope a little bit and look at where the species could survive. So the suite of environments, so different soil moisture types, different light levels, different parts of New England. And so we collected seeds, as you said, from different populations already in the wild. And then we actually planted out in a experimental biogeography approach. So we had plots in Aroostook County in far northern Maine. We had plots in Vermont and southern Connecticut to really look at the full breadth of possible environments and ecosystems.
And what did you find?
So, you know, the quick and dirty was that different parts of the life cycle really responded differently to the suite of environments. So, for example, with garlic mustard, the conventional wisdom is that it likes kind of cool, moist, shady areas. But what we found was in the open, sunny areas, it had really high seed output. And so as we looked forward with climate change, we found that areas that were warmer had higher seed output, but then it had better survival for the adults in the cooler climates. And so for garlic mustard, with the warming temperatures and changes to precipitation, we found that southern New England, where garlic mustard is already prevalent, is actually less likely for a new establishment, which was a huge, huge surprise for us.
So garlic mustard may be following the broader trend of a lot of native species as well and moving northward out of southern New England.
Exactly. And so I think that was the most surprising result from our study, was that as we, in the next 30, 40 years, the likelihood of new establishment for garlic mustard may be less in southern New England. And, you know, that has big implications for large-scale management, for, you know, I work at a small land trust now, and how we think about triaging our invasive species management, you know, studies like this can help us think about where we want to target our efforts.
Japanese barberry was exactly the opposite. It kind of confirmed the conventional wisdom that invasives might thrive and spread in areas where they are already as climate change progresses. So what explains that difference between garlic mustard is moving out of the area and Japanese barberry is likely to expand?
I think it's kind of a combination of things, but generally, you know, it's a long-lived shrub. So once it establishes in an area, it's really hard to get rid of it. And it has, so while it doesn't produce maybe as many seeds in any one given year, just the longevity of it over time can kind of reproduce and produce and produce. And so it really establishes well and has really good seedling survival in these kind of warm, semi-dry conditions that we're going to see increasing more and more with climate change. And so not only are there areas under current climate conditions that barberry still has an opportunity to occupy, like in northern Maine, but that the higher likelihood of establishment is just going to be increasing, our results show, with climate change.
Since this work really challenges the simplistic idea that all invasives will do well with climate change, does it instead give you any new principles that you might be able to apply more broadly? Or does it really just mean that every single species, if we want to understand how it's going to respond, we're going to have to do these big, complicated experiments to work it out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it points to the fact that, you know, as we know, species are very individual and they come from completely different areas. And so, you know, while garlic mustard is a native to Europe, we can look at how it responds in Europe, but it comes to this novel environment and there's lots of different competition. There's different, completely different ecosystems. We call them novel ecosystems that they've never experienced before. So it's going to be hard for us to predict in a very general sense how each species will respond when there's just all these different complicating factors. And that's why we really push to do this planting out approach in the field where the seedlings were subject to all the different aspects of the environment. I hate to say that, yeah, we have to do these tests for each individual species, but if there's really species of interest, it can be done. And I have to say that our approach is kind of less data heavy maybe than looking at a traditional species distribution models where you need lots and lots and lots of data points. So we're trying to show how you could do, understanding the uncertainty, you can do a lot with these new invaders too.
Speaking of new invaders, I mean, if garlic mustard is moving to Canada, likely that there are other plants to our south that might be moving into New England. Do we have any idea what those might be at this point?
Well, you know, we can look, you know, fortunately, we can talk to our neighbors in the south and, you know, look at the mid-Atlantic area and look at what's coming north. So we've known for a long time, if anyone's driven south through the D.C. area, for example, kudzu is one of the worst invasives down there. And so we can look at as species like kudzu maybe moving farther north. We know there's a couple of populations of kudzu in Massachusetts already. They've been there for years and years and haven't reproduced. But those are the kinds of things that we're looking at and keeping an eye on for as temperatures change, as spring comes earlier and earlier. What are the kind of, as you say, winners and losers from the mid-Atlantic that might be kind of occupying up here?
Be on the lookout for kudzu. Sarah Boyce is Director of Research and Education at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket, co-author of a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you, Heather.
Next up, the unfairness of climate change. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone, and joining me now is Daniel Faber. He's professor of sociology at Northeastern University and director of the Northeastern Environmental Justice Research Collaborative. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
We've been hearing about some of the impacts of climate change. You're among those who call what we're facing a climate crisis. Why?
Well, I think it's now becoming evident in the scientific community that climate change is beginning to feed upon itself, that there are all these processes that have been unleashed called positive feedback mechanisms, where climate change is beginning to accelerate in a way that's much more severe than was originally predicted. So, for example, the melting of permafrost is unleashing methane, as well as methane burps from the thawing of the seafloor. And the amount of methane that could be released could dwarf the amount of CO2 that has been released by the Industrial Revolution over the past 200 years. So we're now at a point where we're seeing that climate change is, in fact, feeding upon itself.
Climate change plays out in different ways in different places, of course. Here in the Northeast, we're already seeing a variety of impacts, the most dramatic increase in extreme precipitation of any region in the United States. What are some of the other predictions when it comes to New England's future?
Well, in many ways, some of those severe impacts of climate change in the United States outside of Alaska are predicted for New England. For example, the city of Boston recently released a report on projections what climate change can mean here. And they're looking at, under the current emission scenario that we have, business as usual, the temperatures during the summer in Boston, we could see 90 days, as many as 90 days above 90 degrees, and as many as 30 days above 100 degrees. So in essence, we would have the climate of southern Alabama or northern Florida, which may not be a bad thing if you're looking to retire instead of moving to Florida. You won't have to by the end of the century because that climate will move here. But that's a very significant change in our climate. And I think even more disturbing, actually, is looking at what's happening around sea level rise. The studies coming back from the West Antarctic ice sheet and Greenland are really beginning to look at the disintegration of those ice sheets. There was a 92% surface melt over Greenland a couple of summers ago. And if Greenland goes, you're looking at a 20-foot rise in global sea levels. And again, the city of Boston, predicts as perhaps as much as a 7-foot sea level rise by the end of this century, and is beginning to study ways that the city could adapt, because at high tide, essentially, there'd be nowhere for the Charles River to go. It would begin emptying out into the city of Boston.
Those are pretty sobering scenarios, and yet public opinion polls pretty consistently show that Americans, a majority of Americans, do actually think climate change is happening, but they don't think it will affect them. Who will climate change affect? Who is it affecting already?
Those who are most vulnerable to climate change are those people that lack the resources and the capacity to withstand its impacts. They are the most vulnerable. And those are particularly people in the global south. About 300,000 people die each year as a result of climate change. And if you think back to the heat wave, for example, that hit Europe in 2003, 71,000 people died in that heat wave in Europe. And it was typically those who could not afford air conditioning, the elderly who were socially isolated. So those who are the most vulnerable to climate change typically tend to be those who are poorest, who lack the political, economic resources to adapt to the impacts of climate change.
The conflict in Syria is very much on everyone's mind right now. The refugee crisis resulting from destabilization in that region as well. How much of a role does climate change play in that conflict and the refugee crisis that we are seeing?
Oh, I think it played a very significant role. There was a 5-year drought that was really quite devastating in Syria that displaced around 1 million people from the countryside, typically many of them small farmers, and they could no longer live off the land. So they moved into the urban areas where the Assad regime provided very little in the way of social services or support, and created a very desperate situation and contributed to the political instability that we now see ravaging Syria. And the Pentagon has made note of perhaps the greatest national security threat to the United States and many other nations around the world is in the area around climate refugees. The British government estimates that just from sea level rise alone, by the mid part to the end of the century, we could see around 200 to 300 million climate refugees in the world today.
That completely dwarfs what we're already talking about being a crisis.
That's right. So already look at the political destabilization and turmoil that's been created in Europe just around a small level of displacement, a couple million people around the Middle East. And so magnify that by 100. And so it's no secret that the Pentagon considers climate change to be a major concern.
Let's bring this a little closer to home. I mean, we often hear about the inequities of climate impacts on the international scale that you've been talking about, developing nations versus nations like the United States. But really, the same thing is true within the United States as well, right?
Yeah, it is. For example, if you look at New Orleans around Hurricane Katrina, roughly around half of the black population that was displaced by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans has yet to return to the city. There are entire neighborhoods and sections of that city that have yet to be reoccupied. And so if you're a poor person and you lack home insurance and the capacity to rebuild your home that's been devastated by storms or flooding and so forth, then in many ways, we're seeing an uptick in what we call climate refugees, even within the United States. And, just this past year, for example, in Louisiana, we saw, again, major dislocations. Watson, Louisiana had 31 inches of rain in one day, breaking all types of records, massive flooding.
Wow.
So, yes, the United States is not immune, even though most of the significant impacts that we're seeing in the world today are occurring globally. But I think one of the things that's really interesting is really for the first time, I think more and more Americans, if you look at the concern around climate change, it's been increasing. And I think that's because it's really becoming more and more visible and you can feel it. So this is the first year ever where we've had a tornado in February in the state of Massachusetts. And if you recall, we've set all times of heat records this winter with 70-degree temperatures in February. And going back to Syria and the Middle East, for example, within the last 2 years in the summers, they've seen heat indexes of around 156 degrees, which is a combination of heat and humidity, which they saw that in Iraq and other parts of the Middle East for shorter periods of time. But these were all-time records. And you're beginning to see certain areas of the world that are being rendered uninhabitable due to climate change.
Massachusetts tends to get a lot of recognition for ambitious policies when it comes to pollution and addressing climate change. But you've looked at the inequities of pollution and climate impacts within the state of Massachusetts and found some pretty major disparities. Can you give us some examples?
Well, in communities of color, the cumulative environmental burden around polluting industrial facilities and toxic wastes is over 20 times greater than it is in predominantly white communities. And so what that means is there's a tendency for heavily polluting facilities to be disproportionately located in low-income white communities and communities of color. So, for example, even though communities of color only make up about 9% of all the communities in Massachusetts, they receive over 40% of the carcinogens that are released by industry in the form of air pollution and water pollution. So it's no secret then that throughout the United States, there's been a tendency for many corporations to locate their most dangerous or most polluting facilities in communities that lack the political economic power to resist the imposition of these facilities. In the state of California, for example, they commissioned Sorrell Associates to help them locate incinerators, which are very, very dangerous. They emit toxins and other types of heavy metals. And no community in California wanted to accept these. And so on page 51 of the report of this consulting firm, they recommend that in no such circumstances does such a polluting facility be located within 5 mile radius of a white middle class community.
Wow.
And so instead they should target low income communities, communities of color, Catholic communities because they were considered to be more conservative, and rural communities.
I mean, it's really that blatant.
In many instances, it is, and there are similar reports, for example, in North Carolina and elsewhere, where similar recommendations have been made on behalf of the state in terms of where it should locate these types of polluting facilities. So in Massachusetts, actually, we have some of the worst disparities with regard racial and class disparities with the location of these hazardous waste sites. In fact, Massachusetts is ranked among the worst in terms of the nation with racial disparities around air pollution. Boston ranks as the fifth worst city in having some of the most extreme racial disparities in exposure to air pollution.
I mean, Boston got some unwanted attention in popular media recently for being called the most racist city. It sounds like, you know, your research kind of bears that out in terms of environmental disparities.
Well, yes, and my work around much of the country, including the Deep South and the Western United States, you find some of the most extreme racial disparities that exist anywhere in the country exist here in Massachusetts. But on the other hand, Massachusetts has been a leader in sort of developing new policies and around issues of environmental equity and environmental justice. Shortly before Governor Deval Patrick left office, in fact, he issued an executive order on environmental justice that would begin to remedy many of these disparities, targeting greater enforcement in communities of color, low-income white communities, and targeting, you know, increased restoration work and establishing environmental amenities like parks in these disaffected communities.
I mean, climate change was a signature issue for Governor Deval Patrick, and he did take up this issue of environmental justice, especially late in his administration. Do you feel like that progress has continued under Governor Baker?
I think it's stalled. We've been waiting for a lot of clarification around how he will enforce the executive order. And in the meantime, again, we've seen this process by which the targeting of communities of color for some of the more polluting industrial facilities continues. And I'm thinking, for example, in Brockton, which is a low-income community of color, for a new power plant in which there's been serious contention. So I think the Baker administration needs to do more and build upon what Governor Patrick has created in the past.
At the federal level, President Trump has called for drastic cuts to EPA's climate science and also environmental justice programs at that agency. You know, it's kind of interesting, though, over the past couple of years, investigations by the Center for Public Integrity and the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights have actually found that that office, the Office of Environmental Justice, dismissed 9 out of every 10 complaints, has never actually formally found a violation of the Civil Rights Act with regard to environmental issues. So how much of a loss would it actually be if that office were completely defunded or eliminated?
Well, you're right, and I think there's been very slow response. Flint was one of the few exceptions where they found an example of environmental discrimination.
And I even in that case, I mean, it took the EPA quite a while. There was a lot of dragging of feet and not wondering if this was really, you know, a memo where they actually said, we're not sure this is the community where we want to stick our neck out.
That's right. But in other areas, the EPA has done tremendous work in communities of color in terms of targeting enforcement. And I think a lot of it has to do with the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, where representatives of communities of color, low-income white communities, had a greater voice in many of the EPA decision-making processes. So at the same time, we did see some significant progress in many areas, even though a lot of the legal challenges that were taking place for the Office of Civil Rights were getting nowhere. And I think one of the things that's really disturbing, for example, the Trump administration recently announced that they were going to abolish the offices that deal with lead poisoning. Mustafa Ali, who is head of environmental justice at EPA, recently resigned. And I think what we're looking at is the beginning of a really unprecedented attack by the Trump administration on the EPA and other agencies charged with environmental protection. And you're looking at a 31% cut in the budget of EPA, and that's devastating. In fact, Myron Ebel, who headed up the EPA transition team, he came from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, heavily funded by the oil and gas industry and other major corporate polluters. In an interview, said, you know, the goal here is actually eviscerate the agency, to so decimate the agency with these funding cuts that even if a Democrat is elected in the following elections, the agency would not be able to recover. So I think we're witnessing the beginning of what will be an unprecedented attack on environmental protection in the United States.
You're going to be speaking to a group of almost 150 junior high and high school students from across Cape Cod tomorrow. You know, this message of climate change isn't fair. It affects everybody and affects the most vulnerable among us the most. That message really resonates, I can say, with all three of my kids, right down to my 5-year-old. So how do you talk about these kinds of issues with, well, really with anyone, but especially with kids, without it just becoming overwhelmingly depressing?
Well, I mean, it's a significant challenge because in many ways, there's so many different dimensions to climate change, you know, in terms of these injustices. There's the class and racial injustices within countries. There's the injustices that occur between the North and the South because so many of the impacts of climate change are being felt more deeply in the global South right now. There are islands in the Pacific, for example, that are beginning processes of being evacuated. And then there's these intergenerational injustices, where many of the most severe impacts of climate change are going to be displaced to future generations. And in many ways, this is their issue. It will be the issue of these younger generations and generations yet to come. And I think the way to approach it is not necessarily by fear-mongering. I think the science is very sobering, and we should be alarmed. In many ways, it is a planetary crisis. But I think we should also see it as an opportunity and present a positive vision of the future, that if we can build a new economy that transitions away from a dependence on fuels from hell, like oil, gas, and coal, to a new economy based upon fuels from heaven, such as wind and solar, and if we can find ways to detoxify our economy, that we could build a new society which offers a higher quality of life, a better way of living, for these future generations. We can offer a source of inspiration and not just fear. And I think that's the challenge that the climate justice movement faces now in the United States. If we want to build a more transformative environmental politics, that's to offer a vision of a better society, and that if we fuse issues of social justice and economic justice along with climate change, then we can create this positive vision that will excite people and I think allow us to build a mass movement that is capable of taking on the most powerful industries in the world that are absolutely necessary to bring about these changes.
That's Daniel Faber, an environmental justice researcher at Northeastern University. Danny, thanks.
Thank you very much.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Finally today, we turn our attention to the world's coral reefs. The news in recent weeks has been dismal. A massive portion of the Great Barrier Reef has bleached 2 years in a row, and leading scientists fear it may not be able to recover. Joining me now is Ann Cohen. She's an associate scientist with tenure in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Ann, good to have you on the show again.
Morning, Heather. Nice to be here.
All right, let's start with the basics. Explain the difference between bleaching and death for corals.
So I think the first thing that you need to understand, or folks need to understand, is that all coral reefs in the world are built from calcium carbonate that's made by coral polyps. That's the little animal that people refer to as coral.
And it's almost like a skin, right, over the huge
yes.
calcium
so
skeleton.
So the reef-building corals are colonial. So millions of little polyps are all living together in one colony, and they are together producing this calcium carbonate that forms the skeleton. And millions of skeletons over thousands and thousands of years form the reef substrate that we scuba dive on and fish on and refer to as coral reefs. Now, most of those coral animals, live in symbiosis with a single-celled algae called zooxanthellae. And algae, like all plants, photosynthesize, they fix carbon, and they provide that they actually transfer that carbon to the coral animal.
So the animal's kind of feeding off of these algae that live inside it.
The carbon from the algae is the main source of food for corals all across the world.
And when they bleach, that's those algae basically being spit out.
Exactly. So usually in a healthy coral, those algae are living inside the cells of the coral polyp or the coral animal. And when it gets too hot, that relationship, a usually nice symbiotic relationship, breaks down.
Do we know why?
There are a lot of very clever people working on this problem. At least one explanation is that the algae start to produce reactive oxygen species, which are toxic for the coral. And so the coral spits them out. Now, once the coral ejects its algal symbionts, its main food source is gone. And so the coral basically starts to starve. And that's what bleaching is. The reason it's called bleaching is because corals get their color from the algal symbionts that live inside their tissues. And once those symbionts have left the coral, what you really see is a transparent tissue, coral tissue, with the white skeleton beneath it. It looks like it's been bleached.
So it's not immediate death, but especially if they can't get new algae back, then you could see the coral dying. And with the Great Barrier Reef, this is actually 2 years in a row that a massive portion of the reef has bleached. The majority of corals over a large area has bleached. How dire is this for the Great Barrier Reef?
It looks like a significant portion from the reports that have come in. I wasn't a part of the study, but from the reports that have come in, looks like a massive portion of the Northern Great Barrier Reef has bleached and died during this 2015-16 El Nino cycle.
Is that something that it can recover from?
Coral reefs can and do recover from bleaching-induced mortality, but for most reefs, it takes a really long time. And the problem is that these bleaching events are coming fast and furious now. So, for example, the Great Barrier Reef bleached in 2014, 2015, 2016. And then again, it looks like it's starting to bleach again this year. If these bleaching and mortality events come too fast and furious, much faster than the reef can actually recover, eventually there's nothing left.
Now, the general target, if you go to like the UN level and the Paris Climate Agreement, there's been this agreement that we need to limit warming, total average global warming, to 2 degrees Celsius. You've just published a study, and there have been multiple different studies on multiple different fronts over the past several years that have said, hang on, that might not actually be a good goal. That might be still too dangerous. And you've actually just published a study of one particular reef in the South China Sea that sheds some light on what 2 degrees of average warming might mean for coral reefs. And it's not a good picture. I mean, what did you learn from this one particular reef?
What happened in the northern South China Sea on this atoll called Dongsha Atoll that we've been working on now for several years was the oceans around the atoll, the open ocean that surrounds the coral reef, started to warm during this last El Nino cycle. So early in 2015, the water started to warm. And at the peak, the ocean was about 2 degrees centigrade warmer than it is normally during that time of year.
So kind of mimicking or forecasting what we might see with 2 degrees average warming.
Yes. Now that warming on its own was not enough to cause a mass scale bleaching and mortality of the corals on this atoll. And in fact, the NOAA Coral Reef Bleach Watch, which alerts scientists and communities across the world that bleaching could happen based on the sea surface temperature forecasts. The NOAA Bleach Watch wasn't sounded out for this area at that time because the temperatures of the open ocean just weren't too high. But what happened on Dongsha was that the winds weakened, the waves were much lower than normal. Wave heights were lower. And so water didn't move across the reef as fast as it usually does. And so the what we call the residence time of the water on the reef increased. The water just sat there. There were no waves to push it off. There were no currents to move it along. And when water just sits there and bakes in the sun,
it just gets warmer and warmer. Yeah.
So we had a warmer than normal ocean, 2 degrees warmer than normal ocean water moving across the reef. So it was warmer than normal. And then it just sat there and baked in the sun. And within a few weeks, it was 6 degrees Celsius higher than it usually is.
I mean, 6 degrees doesn't always sound like a lot, even if you translate it to Fahrenheit, right? The temperature could go up and down. The air temperature around us could go up and down 6 degrees in a day, and it's no big deal. Take your jacket off, whatever. But 6 degrees of ocean temperature persisting for those corals, clearly that's enough.
So we're talking about a 6 degree average temperature. That means that the highest temperatures during the day are higher by 6 degrees, and the lowest temperatures at night are higher by 6 degrees. Now, corals start getting unhappy when the temperatures just go up by 1 degree. So what we saw just over a couple of weeks was a healthy coral reef ecosystem. In fact, our measurements show that it's the fastest growing reef system in the world. Suddenly, overnight, matter of a few days, corals bleached, and 50% of them had died by the time we left the study site in July of 2015.
You were actually there watching this happen in the water every day, watching this bleaching occur. Is that something you'd ever seen with your own eyes before, that whole process? What did you learn from that?
What was amazing, I had flown out to the atoll. It's about a two-hour flight from mainland Taiwan. It's a very remote place out in the middle of nowhere in the northern South China Sea. And I had flown out there to join my graduate student, Tom DiCarlo, who was conducting his PhD research on the reef. And we'd been studying the reef system for about 3 years at that time. And we were snorkeling across the reef, actually picking up some of the instruments that we deployed to measure salinity and temperature and nutrients, etc. And we noticed as we were snorkeling that huge tracts of coral had started to turn white, and it was just incredible. They just looked like Christmas trees, you know, white full, with snow, covered in snow.
Like the white fake Christmas trees.
Exactly. And it was just expansive. And so we thought, let's keep an eye on this. It could be a transient event. It could be that the corals are just bleaching because it got too hot during the day. And they'll return to their normal color. And so we left because we had to get the next flight out of the atoll. There's only a couple of flights a month, so we had to take that flight. And the reports kept coming in from our colleagues still at the Dongsha Atoll Research Station that the bleaching was continuing. And so I was home in Woods Hole. My student Thomas was still in Taiwan, so I said, don't come back. Get on the next flight out.
And go back.
And go and find out what's going on. And by the time Tom had gotten back out, everything was bleached, 100% bleaching, and about 50% of the corals were already dead.
One of the commonalities, you've mentioned the role of El Nino, the fact that it was an El Nino year when that happened. Last year, the bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef, again, El Nino, this periodic phenomenon that raises water temperatures. What are we learning about the relative importance, I guess, of the overall global warming process as opposed to these shorter term, really almost weather events? Are they actually more important when it comes to understanding when and where bleaching is going to happen?
You make a really good point. There's two things going on. The one is the secular warming. That's what we think of as the global warming trend. So, for example, the tropical oceans have warmed by almost 1 degree Celsius since the Industrial Revolution, the start of the Industrial Revolution around 1850. And then there are these interannual events, one of which, the most well-known of which, is probably the El Nino Southern Oscillation. And these cause massive warming across the Pacific basin that have impacts across the world in terms of climate, droughts, floods, et cetera, et cetera. And those can last for several months at a time. But what appears to be happening with the El Nino is they're actually getting stronger and hotter. So, for example, in the last 3 decades, we've seen 3 of the strongest El Ninos on record. These have been called super El Ninos. That was in 82, 83, 97, 98, and then 2015, 2016.
I mean, it makes sense.
Is another super El Nino.
You're layering a short-term warm event on top of a long-term warm event. Obviously, the end result is going to be even hotter.
Exactly. And these El Ninos are just, there's so much heat being stored in the ocean now that these El Ninos, which are kind of like the ocean trying to return to equilibrium, appear to be getting bigger. And this is one of the main concerns about global warming, is how does the secular warming interact with these interannual and decadal scale climate modes to force these extreme events like we saw in 2015, 2016.
We've got less than a minute left. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's much good news here. Is it too late for coral reefs?
I don't want to say yes. I don't want to say yes.
But you're finding it hard to say no.
Some days I'm depressed, but other days I'm hopeful. There are many, many very well-meaning folks out in the world who are really putting their best effort forward to reduce CO2 emissions, which ultimately has to happen in order to stop global warming and to save coral reef ecosystems. But then there's also another light at the end of the tunnel, in that we do see some coral reef ecosystems, some coral reefs, they're not many, that appear to be able to hang on through these events.
Well, we will have to talk about the good news a little bit more another time. Anne Cohen of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Anne, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.